Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN World Food Programme, WFP, said on Tuesday that it was being forced to pause the distribution of food aid to needy families in northern areas of Yemen under the control of authorities in and around the capital, Sana'a. The region has been under the control of opposition Houthi forces since internationally recognized government forces were driven out of the city in 2015. WFP said that despite negotiating with the authorities for nearly a year to provide a more limited aid program that would reach around 6.5 million in need versus the current 9.5 million, no agreement has been reached. The scaled-down program would match available resources to the neediest families, said WFP, adding that ending distribution for now was a difficult decision that had been reached in consultation with donors. Food stocks in areas under the Sana'a-based authorities' control are now almost completely depleted, and resuming food assistance, even with an immediate agreement, could take up to 4 months due to supply chain disruptions, the agency added. WFP said it would continue its programs to limit the impact of the pause for as long as the agency has sufficient funding and cooperation from the Houthi authorities. In areas of Yemen under government control, food distribution will continue with a heightened focus on the most vulnerable, the agency added. The situation for Gazans is getting worse by the hour, the UN health agency WHO said on Tuesday, after some of the heaviest Israeli shelling in the enclave since Hamas militants massacred some 1,200 people in southern Israel and took around 240 hostages on the 7th of October. Speaking from the southern city of Rafah, Dr. Rick Peeperkorn, WHO's regional representative, described further bloodshed after the resumption of Israeli bombing last Friday. He said there had been intensified bombing going on throughout the south, noting that in the last couple of days there had also been a vastly increasing number of internally displaced people travelling from central Gaza. Echoing those concerns, UN Children's Fund spokesperson James Elder cited international humanitarian law that obliges military forces to take all feasible measures to protect civilians. He said it was unacceptable to unilaterally declare that they should go to so-called safe zones. And finally, the Sporting Chance Forum got underway in Geneva on Tuesday, bringing together players from across the sporting world to discuss the future of sport and human rights, engage in collective action, and make pledges that will help shape the coming decades in this important field. SCF23, as it's known, is officially part of the UN's Human Rights 75 initiative, which celebrates the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. UN Rights Chief Volker Türk said that advancing human rights in sports can catalyze social transformation. He also raised strong concern over racism, racial discrimination, and xenophobia in sport. Athletes, family members, and fans from minority communities all face frequent abuse, which is able to thrive in a culture of near impunity, he warned. He highlighted the case of Brazilian football player Vinicius Jr., who's faced hateful racist slurs in recent months on the pitch of legendary football club Real Madrid, highlighting what Mr. Türk said was a grim reality that's often minimized by industry insiders. Gender inequality and discrimination against women and LGBTIQ plus people also remain widespread, Mr. Türk warned. Matt Wells, UN News.
Log Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio for Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
Coming up in the second hour...
London was founded in 46 AD. It was a military base called Londinium. Does that give a present-day Italian person the right to come to London and take my home?
Of course not.
Of course not. However, our entire international setup says the exact process is acceptable in Palestine.
British-Iraqi hip-hop artist Lowkey has an MA from SOAS University of London. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
naughtiest baby, still you're sweet as can be. First you treat me nice, then you're cold as ice. You're a puzzle to me. Good little, bad little you. What makes you tease like you do? I look into your angel eyes. They're little devils in disguise. One little, two little lips I crave. They lead me on, then they say, behave. And who knows it too? Good little, bad little you.
Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
Sea levels have reached record highs and the rise is accelerating. Sea surface temperatures have reached a record high. And sea ice levels in Antarctica have hit a record low. We are living through climate collapse in real time and the impact is devastating. This year has seen communities around the world pounded by fires, floods, and searing temperatures. Record global heating should send shivers down the spines of world leaders.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at COP28 in Dubai, November 30th, 2023. Along with hundreds of scientist guests, I have been saying that for years. This year, the global pot came to a visible boil, and we are in the early phase of a hot El Niño trend for 2024 and beyond. In years past, we had correspondents calling in from the COP climate conferences and expectations of action. This year, an estimated 70,000 people burned through the long flight to Dubai, many of them in private planes. Humans still don't get it. Giant fossil fuel corporations and nationals have announced expanded production. Their trillion-dollar projects have already begun. Their investments will heat the world beyond 3 degrees this century. The climate conference is being held by the oil industry, literally by the CEO of a giant Middle East fossil fuel maker. Did they buy the world's only climate agency, like the Saudis buy sports networks? You and I know there will be a lot of green talk and very little action at COP28, even as global emissions continue to rise. Don't expect much coverage on Radio EcoShock. The real world is talking. The glaciers, storms, disappearing species, and lakes. Let's listen to what they say.
Radio EcoShock.
The best ice scientists in the world just issued this stark warning. 2 degrees of warming commits all future generations to shrinking land and a deader ocean. The melting temperature of water is not open to negotiation. The ice world breaks down well before 2 degrees C of warming, and we are heading towards 3 degrees or more on our current course. 2 degrees is too high, says the new State of the Cryosphere 2023 report. Joining us is scientist Twyla Moon. Dr. Moon is deputy lead scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. From Boulder, Colorado, Twyla Moon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So the cryosphere is wherever snow or ice appear, and that's about 10% of the land surface of the planet, plus some of the sea surface that's frozen over with sea ice. How did this frozen world react to record-breaking heat in recent years?
Unfortunately, as you might imagine, the Earth's frozen components, so we're talking about snow, ice that forms on the ocean as sea ice, land ice that forms glaciers with the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets, and also frozen ground or permafrost. And all of these elements are extremely sensitive to small changes in temperature, just as the ice in your freezer is. And these warming temperatures have been producing rapid and really somewhat devastating effects for these frozen components of the Earth system.
For a long time, scientists knew climate tipping points existed, but could not say when or what warming would trigger them. It sounds like there's more certainty now for tipping points in the cryosphere. Tell us more.
Scientists have been continuing to improve our understandings of the Earth system and the processes at play, including improving our understanding of these frozen parts of our Earth system. And we often don't, as scientists, necessarily talk about tipping points as much as somewhat thresholds. I think sometimes folks with a word like tipping point can get an idea that things are going along fine and then suddenly fall off the end of a cliff. Unfortunately, things are not going along fine for the cryosphere right now, and those impacts are going to worsen into the future. What we do start to understand are these thresholds in which we start to have more irreversible damages. And those might be changes that would require many thousands of years for us to see, for example, regrowth of glaciers, or to have the possibility of slowing and beginning to again freeze ground as permafrost. So as we're understanding how these frozen parts of the Earth system work, we are being able to hone in more closely on what should be some of our global temperature goals in order to protect these systems.
And one of those may be the West Antarctic ice sheet. There's a suggestion in the report that we've already passed that and that will be lost.
Yes, there are several instances where we have already begun what could be irreversible losses. The West Antarctic ice sheet is a good example. And that, of course, is related to sea level rise that's showing up on coasts around the world. But even when we have components like ice sheet melt that contribute to sea level rise, we know now, even with very low emission scenarios, we are likely to see a continued uptick of sea level. However, for us as humans, as communities, as economies to adapt, the rate of that change is really important. And that's where we can still see a lot of influence of human action. So if we are undertaking strong action and following some of the lowest emission pathways, we see a substantial decrease in the speed at which oceans are rising and the total amount of additional ocean rise that different coasts will see. And that, of course, is really important because that would mean we have more time to adapt and might not see the scale of changes that we would see if we were to continue on our current pathway of emissions.
Well, another threshold in the report concerns what happens to the oceans when CO2 goes higher than 450 parts per million. We're currently crossing around 424 parts per million in November of 2023, and that's 50% higher than pre-industrial times already, and it's increasing at a faster rate. What does happen in the ocean at that 450 parts per million rate?
You're correct. I think sometimes folks forget that as we put carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, the ocean does important work taking up that carbon dioxide, which helps to keep it outside of the atmosphere and not produce as much warm temperatures. However, when the ocean is taking up carbon dioxide, that results in ocean acidification. And a more acidic ocean is a problem for those small species, many of them at the base of the food pyramid, that need not as acidic conditions in order to build the shells and essentially kind of their structures of life. And we see that already polar oceans in the Arctic and the Antarctic are taking up carbon dioxide more rapidly than other oceans around the world, and so they are seeing fairly rapid ocean acidification, and we can already observe that there are species that are seeing damage to their shells and body structure because of this increased acidification in the ocean. So that's something we have to be very concerned about in regards to continued emissions into the future. And ocean acidification is a process that is another one of these that is not reversible, except for over many thousands of years.
The big producers of coal, oil, and gas are developing more fossil fuels, enough to take us to 3 degrees warming and beyond. But let's hope for a miracle. Somehow the global average temperatures are only 2 degrees C over pre-industrial by 2100. Is that good? Is that safe? What happens at 2 degrees of warming?
2 degrees of warming is certainly better than 3 degrees of warming. But unfortunately, even at 2 degrees of warming, we see some very significant and irreversible influences for the cryosphere. So first, I think it's important for listeners to remember that that global average temperature we talk about is just that, a global average. And actual temperature increases in different places in the globe can be higher or lower. Unfortunately, the Arctic is one of the fastest warming parts of our planet. It's warming several times faster than that global average. So if we were to limit global average to 2 degrees Celsius, we will be seeing higher temperatures in the Arctic. And all of the components of the cryosphere are highly sensitive to that temperature change. So as we are getting to 2 degrees, if we were to be limiting ourselves to 2 degrees, we would, at that temperature, be seeing a substantial loss and total loss of some glaciers around the world, certainly tropical and low-latitude glaciers. We'd also be committing ourselves to substantial long-term sea level rise, ongoing thawing of permafrost. This is important in part because as we thaw that frozen ground and permafrost, it releases additional heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere, which we will have to deal with as well as what we humans are putting into the atmosphere. So 2 degrees, as I said, certainly better than limiting to higher temperatures, but at that 2 degrees, we would be seeing some very significant and devastating impacts for communities and people around the world.
Based on detailed studies of markers from the past, ice can melt much faster than it is formed. What does that tell us about the way this planet changes from an ice house to hothouse climates?
Yes, it's a really important observation that we are not able to grow, for example, a Greenland ice sheet as quickly as it might be able to disappear. In the past, the Earth's changes, which of course have the Earth in the past has seen temperatures much higher than today, and it's also seen temperatures much lower than today. Of course, humans were not around at those times. We weren't trying to maintain a civilization and have agriculture and stable communities and infrastructure. So as the Earth changed in the past, there was simply a longer period of time of moving into or out of an ice age. And what we are doing today is we people are significantly increasing the pace of this change in our atmosphere, adding heat-trapping gases, and that's producing very rapid responses, for example, from ice sheets. Unfortunately, if we were to stop our warming now and achieve, for example, a limit at 1.5 degrees, that doesn't mean that we're getting to yet grow back glaciers and ice sheets. It would simply be a reduction of loss into the future. It takes much colder temperatures to start to build the ice because it's something that is built through snow year after year after year.
We could spend a whole interview on each chapter in the Cryosphere Report. It covers ice sheets and sea level, mountain glaciers, permafrost, sea ice, and ocean acidification. Let's go back to the permafrost. Could you give us a snapshot of the current situation, and are there danger points approaching there?
Yes, so permafrost is frozen ground. Actually, about a quarter of the northern hemisphere is underlain by permafrost. I think some folks are surprised to learn that. And as permafrost is exposed to warming air temperatures, those temperatures in the air can start to move down into the ground and warm the ground and thaw the permafrost. You can almost imagine taking a frozen chicken, out of your freezer and setting it on the counter. As it thaws, it doesn't become a puddle of water. Rather, you're left with the chicken. So that's the process of thaw, of frozen ground. And just like as you're taking that chicken out of the freezer, when it was frozen, you could not worry about eating it for months. But once it's thawed out on the counter, microbial activity is getting started, and you better eat that chicken pretty fast. Well, with frozen ground, as it's thawing, that's also allowing microbial and activity to happen and starting to release heat-trapping gases. So folks who are living in places with permafrost are concerned about thaw because it can cause potholes to open up in the ground or uneven patterns that can get in the way of roads working properly or cause damage to buildings. And people who are far away from permafrost should be very concerned about these additional heat-trapping gases that get released into the atmosphere. And that is a process that is quite slow for reversing, so that is, as we stabilize temperatures in our atmosphere, or I hope we stabilize temperatures in our atmosphere, the permafrost is a bit slower to respond to that and is likely to continue to add heat-trapping gases to our atmosphere for 100 or 200 years that we'll have to be continuing to offset through our human actions.
What are the concerns about rain over Greenland?
Yes, we have seen increased amounts of rain over Greenland, and then we've also seen a lengthening summer melt season. Sometimes I think folks are surprised to realize that rain can be especially problematic for the ice sheet, because not only is that rain falling and not adding extra massive snow, but that rain water is a little bit warmer than the ice that it falls onto and can encourage additional melt. We can also have instances where if we see melt on the surface of the ice sheet, but deep into the interior, that surface melt might trickle down into the ice sheet surface layer some and then freeze again, forming an ice lens that makes it harder for future melt to get caught up in the ice sheet and freeze again, causing that melt instead to go ahead and run off into the ocean, adding to sea level rise. So we've been seeing additional rain, and we've also been seeing some remarkable warm events in Greenland. For example, September of last year, 2022, we saw melt events on the surface of the ice sheet late into September, a time when we would normally be expecting just to be having snow and a buildup of snow and ice mass on the ice sheet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist Twyla Moon from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. We're talking about the State of the Cryosphere 2023 report, 2 degrees is too high. That comes from the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative, a cooperative among the world's best ice and snow experts. Ice experts have one of the longest takes on climate change. You look back hundreds of thousands of years and forward thousands of years, and the long view is even more scary in a way. The public seems unaware of these dangers because they happen in faraway places often. What are the predictions on our current course for sea level rise from ice loss?
Our current course suggests that we might see very high levels of sea level rise. We're currently on course to a 3 degrees Celsius warming by 2100, and that opens the possibility for us to be moving to more than 1 meter of sea level rise average over these next 80 years. Now, when it comes to sea level rise, there are some important processes that we haven't been able to observe directly because, of course, humans have never undertaken this experiment before. We've never existed in a time with such high global temperatures as we see now or that we're headed towards. And so there are some processes about how ice sheets move and lose ice that we're not yet sure how quickly they are able to respond. The concern is that they may be able to respond more quickly than we have earlier imagined, and that opens up the possibility of committing ourselves to multiple, 10-plus meters of sea level rise over the next couple hundreds of years. Of course, that doesn't come all at once. That means ongoing rapid sea level rise that may uptick into the future here and cause a lot of issues with us being able to adapt and adjust our civilizations, because we have many megacities, shipping infrastructure, a lot of coastal activity that we have on the planet now. And of course, we'd like to be able to keep that, or at least be able to have sea levels rising slow enough that we can adapt to the change.
Is it possible we could see shocking sea level rise? I mean, there have been pulses in the past, meltwater pulses up to 4 meters or 13 feet. Might it happen again?
It is possible that we could see some very large sea level increases, particularly as we look past the next 80 years and into the 2100s. That's a period where we could see a stark increase in rates of sea level rise beyond what we've experienced in this point or expect in the next few decades. And I sometimes am reminded to think like folks who have existed in these places for millennia, thinking about Arctic indigenous residents who will often talk about timescales of 7 or more generations or multiple thousands of years. They, of course, maintained their societies on these long timescales. So sometimes it can sound like 80 years is very, very far away from now. But in fact, it's just around the corner, and a child born today will be influenced by those events in 80 years.
Can you pick out one more important story from the report, perhaps something you consider underreported or underestimated?
I often think that folks don't fully appreciate the important services that are being provided by mountain glaciers and snow. We talk more about sea level rise or thinking about, for example, additional heat-trapping gases from thawing permafrost, but many people don't realize that glaciers all around the world, from the Himalaya to the Andes to the Alps, are providing drinking water, providing agricultural water, providing runoff that is powering hydropower stations, and as well as providing tourism and other local infrastructure. Unfortunately, these mountain glaciers are really in serious trouble, and we could see the total loss of quite a few of them just at 2 degrees warming. And that means drinking water, agricultural water, and power problems for millions of people around the world. And I think that folks often underappreciate how important these smaller glaciers and that seasonal snowpack is for being able to have our water needs met throughout the year.
This report says only 1.5 degrees C will save the ice world and the ways that it currently shapes our climate. Former NASA scientist James Hansen says 1.5 is deader than a doornail. He's all about Earth energy imbalance in watts per meter squared and changes in Earth's reflectivity called albedo. Reading the report, I could not find the word albedo or any discussion of it, even when Antarctic sea ice is almost gone. Did I miss something, or is that for next year?
Albedo was not a primary topic of this report, although that you're correct that it is an important topic as we're losing highly reflective, bright sea ice. We're exposing a dark ocean surface that is better at taking up heat and energy from the sun and then causing further warming. So you're correct that albedo changes are an important topic area, and they can produce what I call vicious amplifying cycles, where we get a process underway and that process starts to grow on its own, even if we might work later to dampen it. And I can appreciate where he's coming from in the sense that we are very, very close to this 1.5 degree limit. And while it is geologically feasible, certainly we have technology. When it comes to economics, addressing the issue now is going to be probably more affordable than if we were to let it go and need to address the impacts and damages in the future. But these social and cultural and institutional changes that we need to really transform our energy system are, I think, the area that requires the most emphasis and also can be the hardest to move. But I don't want to underestimate the potential for rapid social change or for mechanisms like substantial changes in finance and investing to produce rapid changes in how our energy systems work and move us towards a more ambitious pathway than we're on right now.
Yes, the tone of this report is more emphatic than others I've seen in the past. Scientists call for a drastic change of course. Another new emphasis in this 2023 update, the report includes glimpses of the burden we place on coming generations, the climate debt. If we continue trying to maintain this fossil-powered life, what does that mean for our descendants?
It is important for us to think about future generations. Often the conversation stops at 2100. That's only 80 years away, less. But these changes don't stop at 2100, and future generations will be dealing with long-term impacts, and some of the changes could continue to worsen into the future. As I mentioned, sea level rise rates may increase if we're continuing to cause warming. So I think if we were to continue on this three-degree pathway that we're on now, we would imagine a very difficult world for future generations, one in which they're experiencing what I would call global weirding, which is to say many extreme events, both extreme flood and extreme drought, devastating heat waves, and also many events starting to build up on each other or produce compounding impacts, meaning that you might be hit by a kind of devastating sort of weather or climate event, and before you can recover from that, another one has arisen. And finding that those are influencing so many places in the world that people really struggle to be able to help their neighbors. So certainly making changes now can produce rapid positive impacts, thinking about clean air, thinking about creating buildings and energy systems that are going to be more comfortable for us to live in and hopefully more just and more equitable. But there's also certainly these long-term and very important positive impacts that we can have by taking strong action now that is going to reduce risks and damages for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and generations to follow.
My saddest EcoShock interview was with Australian coral scientist Charlie Varon. He cataloged so many colorful corals, went diving and found them, and then watched them die in the warming oceans. Your ice world is still there, but parts of it seem to be inexorably waving goodbye. Do you and your colleagues feel the same emotions?
I would say that my colleagues and I do share those kinds of emotions that are felt by many other types of scientists who are studying portions of our Earth system, whether they be corals or wildlife, folks who are work on food security. I already in my career have seen losses from the Greenland ice sheet that are irreversible. The ice that we've lost there over the last 25 plus years is not something that we can expect to gain back. And I find that deeply saddening. I know that myself and many colleagues are really devastated by the changes that we people have allowed to happen, given that we knew about climate change for many decades now, and scientists have been sharing this information, and industry and policy and business has been aware of it for a very long time. But I also try to maintain an outlook, understanding that change is still possible, and a determination to convince as many people as possible to take really strong, bold actions, and understand that we're in a period of opportunity right now that will not remain open to us for a long time into the future. So we really need to take advantage of this time we have right now during the 2020s to take strong action before some of these vicious amplifying cycles might get out of our control. So I certainly understand all of those difficult emotions, sadness, anger, and others, but I also try to bring in determination and remind myself of all of the areas where we have made progress. Moving towards a 3-degree future is better than we were off a couple of decades ago. And many people are working on solutions and action change. And I have hope that those can continue to grow and more people can jump on board and we can see a lot of strong leadership.
From the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, we've been speaking with scientist Twyla Moon. The State of the Cryosphere 2023 report, 2 degrees is too high, is available free from ICCINet.org, ICCINet.org. You can find links and key samples from the report in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Tim Lenton.
If we carry on the way we're going, I can't see this civilization lasting the end of this century. No chance, in my view, on the current trajectory.
Joachim Schellnhuber.
If we get it wrong, so if we do the wrong things, then I think there's a very, very big risk that we will just end our civilization. The human species will survive somehow, but we will destroy almost everything we built up over the last 2,000 years. I'm pretty sure.
Peter Kalmus.
It's just so... The path we're on is just so dark. It's so bleak. You know, I see tropics that's uninhabitable by humans because it's too hot. It's too humid and hot that our bodies couldn't even survive there. And I see potentially hundreds of millions of people needing to leave that region and go to cooler areas. And that's just the beginning.
We are, without exaggeration, facing a trajectory and impacts that will obliterate the possibility of human civilization within, by the year 2100. And that is not an exaggeration. And the fact that that is not widely known, that the stakes are so extraordinarily high, I think is something that really, really should cause a lot of people to, from media to scientists to hang their heads in real shame and real horror.
Kevin Anderson.
Recent history supports the view from the IEA, the International Energy Authority Agency, that the CO2 trend is perfectly in line with a temperature increase of 6 degrees Celsius, which would have devastating consequences for the planet.
These tipping points have the possibility, they certainly put forward the risk of a cascade that could take the climate, the Earth system, out of our control into conditions that would be an existential threat to us. Well, if that isn't a emergency situation, I don't know what is.
Everybody on the planet now needs to be galvanized to tackling climate change, because it is by far the most important and biggest emergency that mankind has ever faced.
Radio EcoShock.
We were told the big ozone hole over Antarctica was healing to recover by 2066 or even 2045. By 2019, the hole was shrinking. New science questions all that. Potential drivers of the recent large Antarctic ozone holes was a paper published November 22, 2023. The results bear on the safety of geoengineering, too. Hannah Kasenich is the lead author. She is a PhD student at the University of Otago in New Zealand. After winning an AI-related scholarship from Australia, Kasenich and her colleagues broke the long-standing story of ozone. From South Island, New Zealand, Hannah Kasenich, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so just to be clear, there is no hole in the atmosphere. Ozone, a triple form of oxygen, is spread pretty thinly in the upper atmosphere as it is. What is the ozone hole, really?
So I think we'll start by talking about what the ozone layer is in general. So the best analogy to picture the ozone layer is like a duvet blanket, where we have an area of peak concentration high up in the atmosphere, around 30 kilometers. So this is in the stratosphere. And this blanket shields us from UV radiation. It absorbs that radiation and stops it from reaching the surface. And so we need a thick enough blanket of ozone in order to effectively shield us from UV. And what happens during the formation of the ozone hole is this blanket gets thinner, usually from underneath in the lower stratosphere, within what's called the polar vortex over Antarctica.
And how does the ozone hole in this Antarctic spring look, and how would that compare to its first noticed appearance in 1979?
So most ozone holes follow a very similar evolution throughout the spring. So the ozone hole doesn't exist year-round. It forms after each southern hemisphere winter. So what happens is, during the southern hemisphere winter, we have a circulation pattern called the polar vortex, which gets much stronger and circles Antarctica in the stratosphere. This vortex of air contains a pocket of air within it, which it kind of isolates from the rest of the atmosphere. And this pocket of air gets very cold. During the winter, we have no more sunlight reaching the pole. Within that isolated pocket, due to the low temperatures, we have what's called polar stratospheric clouds that form. And they're quite icy and kind of unique clouds that are pretty unique to this pocket of air. So on the surface of this cloud, CFCs get released into more destructive forms. And when you have sunlight returning to the pole in early spring, so mid-August, that starts a chain reaction with those chlorine chemicals, where they deplete ozone pretty rapidly in the lower stratosphere. So almost every year around August, September, we start to see that depletion occurring and thinning this ozone blanket from the underneath. And that ramps up through September and peaks around the month of October. And then we start to see this hole close. And part of the reason that it's closing around this time is due to the polar vortex that contains the ozone hole and largely defines its extent, begins to become less stable. Once the pole warms, you don't have as much of a temperature gradient, which doesn't reinforce that circulation pattern as much. So by November, we see much more ozone over the pole. The vortex usually breaks up, air remixes, and you have the return to a normal ozone layer.
So in general terms, why is a larger ozone hole over Antarctica a cause for worry?
We care about the area of the ozone hole, but we also really care about the depth. So one thing that our study looked at in particular was the depth of the ozone hole at the center. When you have a more extreme thinning of that blanket that protects us from UV, you end up with more UV reaching the surface. In particular, if we think about the month of October versus September, the angle of the sun in the sky is higher later in the spring. So if you have a deeper hole in October, you end up with more UV at the surface. But perhaps more importantly, if you have less ozone for any time over this region in Antarctica, we aren't absorbing UV light as much in that layer over that time. And so that's a big shift in where heat is stored in the atmosphere. What that does is it influences circulation patterns across the entire southern hemisphere. So we see a shift of the circulation belts in the southern hemisphere towards the pole. We get pushed more towards a positive phase of the southern annular mode, also known as the SAM. And so that influences precipitation patterns, temperature patterns, more extreme weather events across the southern hemisphere. And so as far as human effects, those climate and weather effects of the ozone hole are more important than the effects from the UV changes.
So this could impact Australia, New Zealand, where you live, but also, I guess, the southern tip of Africa and a lot of South America. Big changes just because of changes in the ozone coverage.
Yeah, and we see that there's, with the SAM, the southern annular mode, we have had more of a shift towards a positive mode in recent years, something that is tended to be more positive than normal. And we've seen the effects of that across the southern hemisphere.
So your studies about Antarctica only in one part of the stratosphere, just for 3 or 4 months, is that going to be relevant to the overall expectations for ozone recovery?
So when scientists assess the timeline of ozone recovery, it's usually broken into 3 different regions. So one region is the region that we looked at, which is the ozone hole specifically. Even with reduced CFCs, you'll have this polar vortex form. You'll see cold temperatures, lack of sunlight within the polar vortex during the winter. We'll have a little bit less ozone. And then when sunlight returns, usually that ozone will recover. For now, we have extra CFCs that are making things worse and potentially some other effects. And that's what we consider the Antarctic ozone hole. And the timeline for that is projected towards 2065 for recovery. And I don't know if our findings will necessarily change that. That's kind of the next phase of our work. The other region that we look at in terms of recovery is the Arctic ozone hole, which does form in a similar way. So we still have a polar vortex in the northern hemisphere over the pole. You get the unleashing of CFCs into more destructive forms, which deplete ozone in the lower stratosphere. But that vortex is much less stable, so we don't see a consistent hole. And the timeline for recovery of that region is a little bit sooner. And then overall, the third region is just thinning of the general ozone layer. And that's global, and that's more of a less extreme version of ozone destruction. But that destruction is located where people live. So people don't really live in Antarctica or on the North Pole, and that ozone depletion doesn't really affect them directly due to UV. But the rest of the atmosphere still does have destruction due to CFCs, and that's still on track to recover as well.
Although I did find some signs that we should continue to worry about low ozone, in 2018 I talked with Dr. William Ball, then with ETH Zurich. His paper, Evidence for a Continuous Decline in Lower Stratospheric Ozone, Offsetting Ozone Layer Recovery, it was cautionary. And despite public assurances the ozone problem is solved, a stream of new papers continue to ask difficult questions. Hannah, what got you working on this problem?
Well, for starters, I did read his paper, which I found very interesting because of that separation in different atmospheric layers of recovery and then a lack of recovery. And that is partly what prompted us to look at these vertically resolved observations. But even before that, when I began my PhD, it was around 2022, early mid-year, and we had just had the 2020 ozone hole and the 2021 ozone hole, which were notably large and deep. And this was a time where people had been assessing the recovery metrics of the ozone hole through 2018, 2019, and seeing that there were signs of recovery. And now we had 2 more years of low total column ozone values. And so I was interested in seeing what would happen if you added those years to previous analyses that other researchers had performed. And then while that was happening, we ended up doing this analysis during the spring of 2022, which also had another large ozone hole. So now that we have 3 large holes to add on to this trend, I started seeing some interesting patterns just in total column ozone for me to look more in detail, more 3-dimensional at the whole picture.
Yes, you sort of break things down into the chemicals which humans have emitted, which have direct impact, and then there's other natural variable cycles that are playing around here. And the ozone breakers are the halogenated chemicals like CFCs, but many other chlorinated chemicals as well. Have these declined significantly in the upper atmosphere?
So other researchers have looked at the CFCs in the atmosphere and whether they are in fact declining. So I believe the latest status is that things are in fact declining, but there have been the release of a couple new CFCs over the past few years that we are seeing signs of in the atmosphere. So while we're declining, that will take a long, long time for the CFCs to actually leave the atmosphere. And we need to make sure that we are monitoring any new release of CFCs so that we stay on track.
And so your team looks beyond CFCs, though, for other drivers of ozone depletion. And let's look at a couple. And starting with wildfires here in Canada, our north practically burned down this year. We've seen huge, never-before-seen wildfires. What does that have to do with damaging our ozone shield?
Yeah, so that's been a major topic with the recent large ozone hole we've had over the last few years, because we have had extreme wildfires and volcanic eruptions. What those do is they inject particles into the atmosphere, which make the stratospheric clouds inside the polar vortex more prominent. So we're giving more kind of seeds for those polar stratospheric clouds, which allow the increased release of CFCs into destructive forms. So that's a big impact that affects the rate of the CFC destruction of ozone, particularly in early spring and lower in the stratosphere. And so likely that was a major contributor to some of our large ozone holes of recent years. And that's something that we are looking at. Interestingly, the region that we identify in October to have a significant decline in ozone, not just an anomalous amount of ozone destruction, that potentially is higher in the stratosphere than where the majority of the CFC destruction of ozone traditionally occurs due to the worsened wildfires and volcanic effects. And because it's a bit higher up, we started looking at what else interacts with that region. And that's where we see a descent of mesospheric air entering the polar vortex, intersecting with this region where we see declines. And so that's one of the major new links that we found in our paper.
Yeah, I should mention the fires in Northwest Australia are pretty amazing right about now. You report that wildfire smoke can damage stratospheric ozone. Well, so can low ozone lead to a higher fire risk in Australia or South America? And if so, does that make a kind of self-reinforcing circle of low ozone fires and lower ozone?
Well, certainly everything is related, and that's one of the tricky things about studying something like this. Everything will have an effect on other parts of the atmosphere and the climate. And we do see that you might have in more intense dry summers in parts of New Zealand and Australia, which might increase the risk of wildfires. And so that could be a reinforcing cycle. It's probably not the major contributor to some of the kind of long-term trends of ozone, but that's something to keep an eye on.
Okay, so unless we're scientists, another driver in your new paper is kind of hard to imagine. Low ozone levels in Antarctica change polar winds, or is it that the winds change the ozone? What is happening with the southern polar vortex and ozone?
When you have increased ozone destruction within the polar vortex, typically that ends up cooling the air inside of the polar vortex because the ozone heats up the atmosphere as it absorbs UV light. So when you have cooler temperatures within and warmer temperatures outside of the vortex, you end up with a stronger vortex, which also reinforces ozone depletion within it. So that is another feedback mechanism per se. So that's one thing. And then the mechanism that we identify in our paper as potentially related to these declines is a region of air that descends into the center of this calm pocket of air within the polar vortex from the mesosphere, so above the pole, and it descends into the center of the polar vortex and meets up with the bulk of the ozone layer around the September-October timeline.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Hanneke Senich with new research on the continuing ozone holes over Antarctica. It's been a little hard to get to the public the relationships between climate change and the protective ozone layer because they're not a direct one-on-one thing. What else can you tell us about those relationships?
So I think one of the things to know about ozone in reference to some of the other greenhouse gas increases and other elements of climate change is that it is a separate phenomena, but it in some ways interacts. So it even counteracts some of the effects of greenhouse gas increases. And so it's really important to study them independently, but then also assess how those things will influence each other into the future. So if we think back at the timeline of recovery of the Antarctic ozone hole in 2065, that's 40 years into a changing climate. And we have all these other potential changes that we expect to happen in the climate during that time. And so we need to make sure that we understand the drivers of ozone holes today so that we can see how they interact in the changing climate. Potentially, some of their effects will be amplified, and potentially some of these effects will become unimportant in our future climate. But that's something that we have to make sure that we study in order to know when we actually will see full recovery.
Is it possible the South Polar ozone hole could extend over New Zealand, endangering plants, animals, and people there?
Most of the time, the extent of the hole is controlled by the polar vortex. So we don't actually see that vortex grow an area for the most part. But what it does is it's quite dynamic and it almost swings around as it circles above Antarctica. And there are periods where it could potentially be uncovering this ozone hole over the tip of South America or New Zealand, and I guess Australia as well, but that would be less likely. And those are very short-lived events and very rare events, and likely we won't see a more frequent occurrence of these. So that's good news. What we really do care about is within the polar vortex, what's going on in terms of the depth of the ozone hole.
It looks like 2023 will be the hottest year ever. Does that change anything about ozone in the upper atmosphere where you're studying it?
So we still are not sure what precedes a large ozone hole. Of course, we do have the effects of worsened wildfires, certainly. So if that happens early on in 2023, that could be something to look at for the ozone hole next year. And then if we get more information on some of the precursors, looking at maybe temperature and wind patterns going into the Southern Hemisphere winter, we might be able to predict better what the 2024 ozone hole will be like. Overall, an increase in temperature globally, I don't believe has a direct effect over the formation of the ozone hole.
And we've been talking about aerosols and, you know, the dust and industrial particles and wildfire smoke, the pollution from human activity. It usually stays in the lower band of the atmosphere, in the troposphere, but there are growing calls to inject particles like sulfates higher up into the stratosphere. It is geoengineering to cool the planet. Does your study say anything about unplanned risks of solar radiation management with aerosols?
So this is something that researchers have looked in and is noted in the World Meteorological Organization report of the status of the ozone layer. So it's not an area that I study, but it's kind of similar to the wildfire and volcanic effects. Anything inserted into the stratosphere that has the potential to seed more polar stratospheric clouds has the capability of worsening CFC-induced ozone depletion. So when we look at any kind of interference, we need to make sure that we study its effect on all elements of the planet, including ozone.
Ozone depletion over Antarctica has bumped up and down during the last decade. Hannah, what do you expect as we roll up to 2030 and then 2040? Can we even predict where the ozone hole is going?
Well, with such a short time series so far, it's really hard to predict whether what we're seeing today and over the last 4 years is part of a long-term trend or just kind of unfortunate statistical variation where we've had unusually low ozone values over the last 4 years, but those will begin more of a positive trajectory. So that's something to keep watching. I also wanted to note one of the years that we used during our analysis, 2019, was an abnormal year. And a lot of researchers in this field tend to exclude that year from their trends. Just to touch on the reasons for that and potentially if this similar situation occurs in the future, why that might not indicate direct recovery. So what happened in 2019 is we had a sudden stratospheric warming. And what that does is it breaks up the polar vortex early. And as I talked about earlier, the polar vortex is really the vessel that contains the ozone hole. And if that vortex breaks up early due to external effects, we aren't able to see what would have happened to the depths of the ozone layer within the polar vortex later in the spring. And so we might see more of those effects on other years in the future. And hopefully we'll see clear, deeper, and smaller ozone holes in a stable vortex as well in the future. So for me, if I'm looking at future years, if we see a year where we do still have a polar vortex that remains intact, but within that vortex, we have less destruction and earlier closing of the ozone hole, that would be something that I would say is a really good indication of recovery.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners, like what you're working on next?
So the next phase of our work is to dive into what exactly is going on with the mesospheric descent into the center of the ozone hole, and whether that is something that is more of a byproduct of worsened ozone depletion earlier in the spring, or if that is more of a direct contributor to the mid-spring evolution of the ozone hole. So we see that it correlates well with ozone values in October, but if this is something that is largely driving ozone depletion, we need to understand it, and we need to understand what its effect will be like in our changing climate.
The paper, Potential Drivers of the Recent Large Antarctic Ozone Holes, was published in Nature Communications. It's open access, listeners, so you can read it yourself. Published November 21st from Dunedin, New Zealand. We've been speaking with lead author Hannah Kasenich. Find links and more notes to follow up in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Hannah, this is great work. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
What is happening would be a best-selling science fiction plot, except older Europeans can see snow and ice shrinking away in the Alps. Large ice dams have broken in the Himalayan mountains, crushing everything below with epic floods. Greenland already lost so much ice. Iceland put out a memorial plaque for a former glacier. The Antarctic sea ice has become a shadow of its former self. The world's largest iceberg just floated free. This is reality. You can find maps of the new Earth coastlines on the internet. Florida becomes just a stub with southern cities underwater. New York, London, Hong Kong, the list is long, the underwater pyramids of a former civilization. Fertile river deltas feeding a billion humans and countless species disappear under the sea. There is literally less land for the survivors to stand on. The whole rich diversity of coastal areas, including coral reefs, can be wiped away by a single generation of humans, this generation. Reports from COP28 read like the Doom Report, but doom will not be short or merciful. It takes time. Heartless heat and commanding waves increase over centuries once the die is cast. Once the carbon limit is crossed. How awful to know that, to measure the height and speed, to see it coming, and still do nothing but make it worse. If humans survive with a history, the first three decades of this century was the decision time, the beginning of the end. The rest is written, not in stone, but in heat, water, great dying of the species, the quickest and most dramatic change on this planet since the asteroid hit 66 million years ago. As innocent as we seem, we are the asteroid. We kill it all for a holiday flight, another hit of carbon, another day in the death of nature. The Brahmin age of creativity is done. Next is Kali, the Hindu goddess of time, change, and death. We are here for the funeral. As we just heard in this week's interviews, nothing and nobody can stop the ice world from melting once it fully begins. As the Cryosphere report says, we cannot negotiate with the melting point of ice. The ideas and aspirations of our short history, they are melting, they are falling like the ice cliffs into the sea. The ancient past reveals itself again. Crocodiles may hunt in the Arctic. The last fish come to feed among drowned office towers where men sought to control the world. Recently, records were set for the most flights and driving in American history over the Thanksgiving weekend. Nobody knows the trouble we are in. You do. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. This comes from a song I wrote for those who won't listen or don't care.
I bought a beachfront condo, an SUV. My flight to Vegas was worry-free. I don't worry about climate change. Those green freaks can worry for me. There's no such thing as is over, my car loan shot, my closet full of clothes tells you who I'm not. Don't call my number, I'm not home. Don't call another, you're all alone. Don't call me liberal, cause I'm not one. Look at me sideways, I'll show you my gun. Down in the alley, I buy my pills. If the doctor won't do it, can't cure my ills. There's no such thing as climate change. Don't even bother, don't even talk. I don't want to hear, take a nice long walk. Your so-called science, your so-called facts, you're never gonna change the way we act. There's no such thing as climate change.
Climate change.
Coming up in the second hour tomorrow, Thursday, Law and Disorder, a brand new tax cast.
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you there.
That's right, in the second hour tomorrow on Law and Disorder, Thursday. That's a great show, and it's a brand new TaxCast. This came out late last week. Music.
Can get our number. The world's in slumber. Let's misbehave. There's something wild about you, child, that's so contagious. Let's be outrageous. Let's misbehave. When Adam won Eve's hand, he wouldn't stand for teasing. He didn't care about those apples out of season. They say the spring means just one thing to little lovebirds. We're not above birds. Let's misbehave.
Let's misbehave. Let's misbehave.
If you'd be just so sweet and only meet your fate, dear, 'twould be the great event of 1928, dear.
Let's misbehave.
one more hit from the Roaring Twenties. And then coming up is TUC Radio with Maria Gallardon. This is Harry Roy. Isn't it a lovely day? Vocals by Bill Curry.
Lovely day to be caught in the rain. You were going on your way, now you've got to remain. Just as you were going, leaving me all at sea, the clouds broke, they broke, and oh, what a break for me. I can see the sun up high, though we're caught in the storm. I can see where you and I could be cozy and warm. Let the rain pitter-patter, but it really doesn't matter if the skies are gray. Long as I can be with you, it's a lovely day.
Well, it's about 10 minutes. If you'd like to call and visit, you're welcome to. I notice there's several callers. You must press 1 if you'd like to visit on air live. TUC Radio is broadcast on over 60 radio stations in rural communities. Maria Gallardon produces it from her off-the-grid home in Northern California that her and her friends built. It's actually solar powered, and she's been there for quite a few years, and you can always visit with her at tucradio.org. And without further ado, I see no one wants to talk. Here is TUC Radio. Put you on. Okay, sorry about that delay. We had a reluctant caller who put their hands up. Brian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it has. What's up? What's on your mind, Brian?
We're living that dystopian 1984 nightmare we always talked about and thought might happen, and we're living it. Living it, brother.
It's pretty slow. It's a slow motion thing, but yeah, it seems like that.
And the sad thing is, when you really realize, you lift the curtain back, and how few people that are in positions of power that have an ability to make a positive impact on the world and just will not do that. And I've
seen
it, you know.
I was very shocked. I was shocked, you know, these most recent massacres occurring in Ukraine and Russia militarized massacres. In Israel and Gaza. I mean, I was shocked because I really felt President Biden was going to be an old caretaker who wouldn't do anything and just take care of the domestic problems our country's having. And he failed utterly. I mean, I don't think his domestic policies are outshining these horrible massacres that are occurring in both
China
places.
To go into
what
Taiwan. Why wouldn't they? Well, I'm waiting for China to go into Taiwan next, and that'll be the, you know, they say these things come in threes, and you know, but I mean, look, I remember the first time I ever had to pay attention to politics. I was a freshman in high school, and we had to do a paper on the Bush, Clinton, and Perot debate. And I learned a very valuable lesson that night because these two candidates, ostensibly from differing parties with differing agendas on the most important issue, which was the North American Free Trade Agreement and reformation, were in agreement. And the other guy that was saying that was talking about what NAFTA was to bring about in the big picture, the entire establishment, the political establishment, the economists, you know, everybody – everybody was saying what a kook and what a ridiculous person that he was. But what I really took from it is that both parties are essentially, with a few exceptions, different wings on the same bird. And anybody that tries to challenge the status quo, if they can't assassinate you, you'll deal with character assassination. And as far as Joe Biden goes, I mean, he's from Delaware, so I'm from Pennsylvania. And I mean, this guy was a well-known jackass and idiot and moron for 30, 40 years. He voted for every bad trade agreement. He's you know, on the march to globalization, he's been a part of it. Open borders, trade agreements, horrible trade agreements, voted for every war. I mean, this guy's been a jackass for almost 50 years. So, expecting, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And unfortunately, you know, you can look at either party, and there's few exceptions. Now, I can say something that most people wouldn't like that are listening to your show right now, but we had a guy before the current president who was the only president in my lifetime that didn't get us involved in a new war, but he had mean tweets. They can't have that. So a lot of people would rather have endless war, dystopia at home, censorship, you know, record high, the worst inflation since the 70s over a guy that has mean tweets because, you know, it's more important to some people.
Well,
what you actually do, it's what you say. And some people would rather be lied to nicely than told the truth too harshly. And the other reality, too, is that there's not a lot of perfect people in the world that are always going to do and say the right thing. But maybe the mark of whether somebody's on the side of right or not is the type of enemies they have. Like, look at Elon Musk. You know, he had no enemies, and he was beloved by the establishment till about a year or two when he bought Twitter. You know, now this government's trying to sue him. You had people like Bill Gates trying to crash the Tesla stock after he bought X, and a lot of the other billionaires – you know, have tried to destroy his company. The government's trying to sue him into oblivion. The SEC's going after him. None of this happened before he bought Twitter. We're at a point now, what we really should be doing, Mike, is honestly, people should, anybody that really wants to see the world be in a better place, it's possible. Have the disagreements where you're going to have them, but see the bigger picture. because if not, things aren't going to get better. They're just going to get worse.
Well, as to China and the third theater of possible war or possible nuclear war, Taiwan has always been part of China. There's no question that Joe Biden is beating the war drums there. And I got to tell you that Donald Trump, I know there's a significant contingent of congressmen, mainly both parties, who would just as soon go to war and take the Baja Peninsula from Mexico. And that's not out of the thing. There's actually motions to not only militarize the southern border, but AMLO, the president, current president of Mexico, rallied over 1 million people preparing for just the rumor of war on Mexico. And I got news for you. A lot of these people, like Judge Napolitano, who does an excellent series of shows, has guests on that I agree with. As a libertarian, I tend to think he would tacitly support war in along the border of Mexico, and I think that we're under a rude awakening. I think many Americans are under a rude awakening that both parties can't be trusted to stop the military-industrial complex, defund it, and defang it.
By and large, that's true, with few exceptions. I mean, you just have to look on how they vote. You know, why are we continuing to fund the Ukraine war? You know, why do they spend – now, this is where you and me disagree. I mean, it's just a disgrace that we'd be funding a war in Ukraine and actually indirectly funding both sides of a war in Ukraine, funding both sides of a war in Israel and Palestine, but we won't secure our borders. If you don't have borders, you don't have a country. And if you militarizing your borders is not a declaration of war with another country. It's to stop people from coming into your country illegally. Every country has the right to do that. You know, when Trump was actually doing something about the border in his presidency and all those people from Mexico and that were coming into Mexico, many who weren't from Mexico, couldn't get into our country. Guess what? A lot of these politicians, a lot of the Mexicans became, you know, make Mexico great supporters. So, you know, every country has the right to secure our borders. And believe me, Mexico wants their border secured as much as a lot of people here do. It's just that political will is not there because we live in an age of globalization where, you know, national sovereignty, the nation state is supposed to be obsolete. So they want their big global government controlled by, you know, maybe 500 families, you know, moved back to the age of empire.
Good to hear
that dream never went away.
I gotta play Maria Gavard.
Sure thing.
There you go.
Sure thing.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
British Iraqi activist Loki on Palestine and Gaza. From Las Vegas, Nevada, the U.S. podcaster Cyrus Jansen called the hip-hop artist Kareem Dennis, a.k.a. Loki, for an extraordinary history lesson on Palestine and Gaza. Loki is also an academic and holds a master's in Middle Eastern Studies from SOAS University of London. He is Loki.
London was founded by the Italians in 46 AD. It was a military base called Londinium. Does that give a present-day Italian person the right to come to London and take my home?
Of course not.
Of course not. However, our entire international setup says the exact process that I've just described to you is acceptable in Palestine. That's the crux of the issue.
Very honored to welcome in Loki. He is a British Iraqi hip-hop artist, academic and political campaigner. He is a patron of the Stop the War Coalition, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and the Peace and Justice Project, who also holds a master's in Middle Eastern Studies from SOAS University. Loki, I want to thank you for joining today's program and discussing this important topic of Israel and Palestine.
Thank you very much for having me, Cyrus. I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. Now, Loki, you've been an outspoken voice for the Palestinian movement, and I want you to open up today's interview letting our audience know about your experience. To most of the world, an area like Gaza is completely cut off. We only know it through photos and videos, but I know that you have spent a lot of personal time in Gaza. So can you tell us what you've seen there and really what you've learned from your ample time in the area and the region?
I would not say that I spent a long time in Gaza. I visited it in 2009 on the Viva Palestina convoy, during which we were detained by the Egyptian government for around 5 days, and then eventually were allowed to go into Gaza and deliver the aid that we had gathered in the United States and in Britain. Obviously, Gaza was in, at that time, a massively dilapidated state following Operation Castlet at the end of 2008 and 2009, which saw over 1,400 Palestinians killed, the use of white phosphorus, again, the bombing of civilian locations like UN sites, like schools. And essentially, what I saw when we got to the other side after a really interesting and telling demonstration of the Egyptian government at that time, complete complicity with Israeli policies, you know, the siege on Gaza, supported by the United States, enforced by Egypt and imposed by the Israelis. What we were attempting to do was to break that siege, and it was led by a British Member of Parliament at that time. So while I saw in the Palestinians in Gaza a great amount of steadfastness, I saw a will to live, I saw a will to love in what were conditions imposed upon them that were deeply, deeply inhumane. My experience there, I would say, was not comprehensive. It was a very short visit. I later spent almost a year in Nablus, which is in the West Bank.
Okay.
And is a slightly different situation. You have the Palestinian Authority there, which essentially serves as a subcontractor of the Israeli occupation. There is constant security coordination between the Israelis and the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority is trained and managed by former British intelligence officers, a company called Adam Smith International. The neoliberal era has seen a lot of the functions of the state outsourced to these private companies, staffed generally by people who used to do that within the state. And so with the integration of British and Israeli security services, what you have is Britain outsourcing particular functions to the Israelis and the Israelis outsourcing particular functions to the British. And those come in the guise of private British or private Israeli companies. But as I say, they are staffed by former security officials of both of those entities. And so the Palestinian Authority, it has a quota on how many people can be trained within it, what they can be trained in, the use of what type of firearms they can be trained in. So for instance, the British have diktats which come to them from the US and the Israelis that they can only train Palestinian Authority security forces in the use of weapons that can be used at close range, nothing close to snipers or anything like that. And so the Palestinian Authority are tasked with maintaining the political suppression of the Palestinian population in the West Bank. And so, I saw that up close, but I wouldn't pretend that I was privy to any special secret by being there. I believe ultimately that people from the outside of this situation can see it fairly clearly for what it is without necessarily having to go there.
Right.
Obviously, my way in, I was detained by the Israelis and questioned extensively. They had a lot of data about me, about who I was, about my background, about my music.
Right.
And ultimately, I was surprised to be allowed in. I do not believe that I would be allowed in today.
Right, right. Well, I think one of the key things I took away from that, Loki, is I think it's been very interesting to observe this fallout from October 7th and brought a lot more people to the conversation, a lot more people that have never really seen, you know, the struggle between Israel and Palestine, and really for the Palestinians who, you know, have been displaced, you know, since the founding of Israel. A lot of people haven't seen that.
I think ultimately, because you are talking about an asymmetric equation, the Palestinians do not have a military. They do not have an infrastructure which will produce propaganda within the accepted forms of mainstream media. The Palestinians have been aching to be free and have been subject to a form of settler colonialism for around, you know, over 100 years, actually, at this stage, when we look at the Zionist movement from its inception. So there has, for a long time, been an understanding that if you want to present the pro-Palestinian side of the story, you are omitted from the news agenda. So there would be so many hurdles to get through before you even get to the point when the humanhood of Palestinians is properly presented. And so therefore, social media has within it less, still some, but less of a filter to that information. And so you have these inspirational young people like Marteza Azaiza, who you mentioned, taking to Instagram and being able to upload directly what he's seeing in Gaza. And there is a real hunger in the world to see what is happening in Gaza on the other end of the propaganda, which is fed to them. You know, the spokespeople for the Israeli military, like Mark Regev and others, are never off the TV screens in the English language media. Right. You very rarely see somebody who's speaking in support of the Palestinians on the screen if they are not embattled by hostile questioning, which, you know, is akin to interrogation.
Right.
And so people are searching for a different way to understand the Palestinian story. And Martez has, you know, at great risk to himself. We cannot forget that across this period, Israel has killed over 65 journalists. That's just in this period. You know, it was found that across the last few decades, Israel had killed 55 journalists. So in the space of a month, it's managed to outdo the amount of journalists that had been killed by Israel during this period. You know, when we think of the journalists killed by Israel, it's not just Palestinians. You have the example of James Miller, the British journalist. You have an example of Shirin Abu Akleh, who was a US citizen. These people were killed often with the words press emblazoned across their chests. So for Martez to take this risk, and others like Wael Dahdouh from Al Jazeera, who his entire family were killed by the Israelis. You have to remember that Israel has the population registry for Gaza. If you are a journalist and you are traveling back and forth, you give your information to have your recognition as an international journalist working for an international news agency like Al Jazeera.
Right.
There are people in situations where they are wishing they hadn't given their information because Israel is directly, you know, you have the example of Anissa Sharif, the Al Jazeera Arabic correspondent, who has in the last few days received direct threats from the Israelis and asking him to stop his work in the north of Gaza because he was, up until the truce, one of the only journalists still in the north of Gaza. Ultimately, Israel has many different mechanisms through which it works to suppress coverage of what it does. These fantastic, inspirational young people are breaking through that that wall, that invisible wall, and they are being greatly received by millions of people around the world. It's an inspirational thing to see, but of course, very harrowing images are coming out from their accounts.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's truly we live in the social media age. I mean, this is the point where if a conflict happens, I mean, you're really just a few seconds away from uploading that on a platform like an Instagram or Twitter. And I think that has really shown a very big difference. For example, I remember when the United States, when we launched our war on terror in the Middle East, I mean, this was well before social media. And I don't think really a lot of Americans had really any idea what was going on over there in the Middle East. Obviously, I want to shift here now to specifically October 7th, because that is obviously the conflict point. And, you know, obviously that changed the entire future of Israel and Palestine forever. On one side, we see October 7th as the biggest attack against the Jewish people since the Holocaust. But I think it's also caused a lot of people, like we mentioned, you know, to be finally paying attention to the plight of the Palestinian peoples. What are your thoughts on the attack on October 7th? How do you look at that? How do you process that? And I wanted to ask that because I know when you were interviewed by Piers Morgan, it was very fresh after that. We didn't have a lot of information. Now it's almost 7 weeks later. We know a lot more about October 7th. As of today, what is your thoughts on this attack and how things have transpired?
Well, to start with, Israel's prized unit, 8200, which is the signals intelligence unit, the equivalent of GCHQ in England, it monitors and surveils Palestinian communications. It's been found by whistleblowers within that unit to use that information to blackmail Palestinians. This unit was seemingly at that time not working on the weekends, which is really something to behold. Wow. When you also look at the military operation that took place, you saw the launching of an unprecedented amount of rockets to disorientate the Iron Dome system of Rafael, the Israeli arms company, and Raytheon, the U.S. arms company. You know, a lot has gone into the Iron Dome, and it was disorientated in that moment. You then saw the taking of key military posts with people coming over the fence in hand gliders. You know, you have to remember that Palestinians attempted to walk towards the fence around Gaza in 2018 in something known as the Great March of Return. And they were practicing their right under UN Resolution 194, paragraph 11, which gives Palestinians the right to return home. What happened when they attempted to do that? Peacefully walk towards the fence, Israel snipered and injured thousands of them, killed hundreds of them. Among them was the journalist Yasser Murtaja, who had the word press written across his chest. Among them was the medic Razan Najjar. You also saw during that time Gaza become a city of amputees, with thousands of people being targeted directly in their knees by Israeli snipers. You know, as JFK said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. Now, that is to understand what happened on that day. But what you did see was the closest military post to Gaza is the Erez crossing. Now, at the point when it was taken over by fighters from Gaza, you found Brigadier General Rosenfeld of the Israeli military cocoon himself in his office and call in an airstrike on his own base. Now, this is very likely to be the application of a directive which exists within the Israeli military known as the Hannibal Doctrine, the Hannibal Directive, which states that when in a position of danger in terms of hostage taking by the other side, then dangerous actions like indiscriminate bombing can be carried out by the Israeli military. And the Erez crossing was not the only place where that took place. And this has, of course, been documented in Haaretz by Amos Harel and others. But you also have the example of Kibbutz Be'eri. The testimony of Yasmin Porat has been widely spread when she was taken captive by the Palestinian fighters. What her conviction is, what she claims is that the Israeli tanks came and shelled the building in which she was in with other Israeli captives, killing them, including her. Her partner was killed during that time, though it's not clear whether that was from the fire from Palestinian fighters or that was from the shelling by the Israeli military. And that's not the only place where you saw the Israeli military indiscriminately fire on people that were both Palestinian fighters and Israelis from the area. So ultimately, you saw a significant upset. As you know, Israel has worked on isolating the Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, from themselves. You know, Vladimir Jabotinsky, who actually is the most influential Zionist figure by some metrics, while Theodor Herzl is credited as the founder of Zionism, Ben-Gurion is is credited as a very key figure. Also, Jabotinsky had more influence insofar as today in the political entity of Israel, you have more hospitals, schools, cinemas, roads, parks named after Vladimir Jabotinsky than you do named after the other two. Jabotinsky was deeply inspired by Mussolini, by the fascism of Eastern Europe, and he was somebody who had the idea of the Iron Wall being essential to protect this, as he put it, no indigenous population will accept subjugation by alien invaders. And this was the terms in which Jabotinsky talked about it. You know, those early Zionist leaders clearly understood what they were doing as colonialism. Mm-hmm. Seemingly now today, it's only for the consumption of the Western world and English language speaking media that Zionism is presented as anything other than settler colonialism. It was understood very clearly. That was a consensus across the Zionist movement. Both sides of the Zionist movement were very clear, we are colonizing this land. Now, Jabotinsky's idea of the Iron Wall, I would argue, is reflected somewhat in the case of Gaza. You are attempting to build this space that is concealed off and sealed off from yourselves. And with the case of the 7th of October, that was really penetrated in an absolutely unprecedented way. I do believe there are more testimonies coming out. There's the example of a key figure formerly of the Israeli Air Force who has described what happened on October 7th and the few days after it as mass Hannibal, the application of the mass Hannibal, which would lead us to believe that there is significant discrepancies in the way in which these events are being presented to us as incoming savage hordes from the ghetto that Israel created in Gaza.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting is I did see a member of the IDF who had come out and said, you know, originally we had counted 1,400 bodies that were burned or that were, you know, killed, but actually we overcounted because after going through, we had realized 200 of them were actually Hamas. So
yeah.
I do want to talk about now this recent development, which is certainly this temporary ceasefire. There has been some exchanges of hostages from Hamas, also the release of prisoners from Israel. Does this also prove that there is a potential for a political solution to this conflict?
Well, let's start at the beginning of the question.
Sure.
Israel is the only state in the world which processes children through military courts. Children as young as 12 can be sentenced for up to 20 years in Israeli occupation jail for the crime of throwing stones. Israel has under 10,000 Palestinians currently in jail. Some of them are children who have been imprisoned in some cases for posts on social media. Wow. Israel uses the idea of incitement on social media as a crime which it wields against children. Also, you have the case of imprisoned without charge, arbitrary detention, which many Palestinians are subject to. And in fact, in this case, during this time when these prisoners have been released, over 50% of them were held in arbitrary detention. They had not been charged with any crime. Now, when it comes to the general charging of people, as I say, these military courts, which Israel processes these people in, have a prosecution rate of 99.8. So it means that if you enter those military courts, you are very likely to go to jail. And also, a key thing here is that across this period when Israel has released these 165 or so prisoners, it has simultaneously imprisoned new Palestinian prisoners almost the same amount during the very same period. So the point is that Zionism is a maximalist movement. It's a fantastical movement, even from the beginning. The aims that Theodor Herzl was expressing to those who would listen to him were laughed out of the room for several years before he was taken seriously. It took World War I for his idea to be taken seriously, and the Middle East being on the precipice of the British taking hold and the Ottoman Empire falling apart. Yes, it was economically weak in the late 1800s and in the early 1900s. However, it did seem fantastical, this idea of setting up a new state there. And for that reason, you had, you know, the first Aliyah, as it's called, the first movement of Zionist colonists to Palestine was considered a failure because it employed Palestinians to till the soil. And the second Aliyah is where you got the idea of muscular kibbutzism from, because it was a necessity for these people coming from the Pale Settlement of Russia or coming from Eastern Europe and Western Europe. In some cases, though, you know, while it was led by Western Europe in terms of human beings, the early Aliyahs were based on people from Eastern Europe and also people from Yemen. And these people did not really know much about how to deal with the Palestinian soil. And so they had to rely on that labor. But then you had the development of something called the division of labor, which said that you had to establish a whole new labor market just for Jewish people, just for the new arrivals. One of the only places that didn't have that division of labor was the railways during the time of the British Mandate. But then simultaneous to that division of labor that Zionism necessitated, you also had the British Mandate having the obligation to apply the Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration had been issued at a time of war by Arthur Balfour, the foreign minister. The letter was written by Chaim Weizmann, who had helped the British develop smokeless gunpowder in World War One, and that had got him great support from the British establishment for his ideas. And so Chaim Weizmann had been able to write this document for Arthur Balfour. Balfour had issued it. And then when Herbert Samuel became the first High Commissioner of Palestine, the British Mandate, he had the obligation of applying the Balfour Declaration, which meant that the British established separate educational institutions and separate health institutions for both the Palestinian population, the Christians and Muslims, and the Jewish population. So there were separate institutions. This was the foundation of the apartheid state that Israel was and was essentially meant to be. It was, the way was led by the British in several ways. And the thing about Herbert Samuel, which is fascinating, is his son had been in the same legion in the British military in World War One, alongside Ben Gurion and Vladimir Jabotinsky, both of whom would go on to lead the Zionist movement, though on differing wings of the movement. But the point is that you have an unsustainable status quo in Zionism, and it's a status quo that says the Palestinians who have lived there for generation upon generation upon generation do not have the same rights as people who have come more recently. While you have the right of return under UN Resolution 194, you have the law of return in Israeli law, which says that a person who has a grandparent that happens to be Jewish can therefore become an Israeli citizen tomorrow. They go through military conscription. They have a whole different way of settling into that society than people who have lived there for many generations. And so the point is you cannot conceivably see any form of peace or just solution there as long as you prop up this fantastical understanding, which is the constant back projection of somebody else. London was founded by the Italians in 46 AD. It was a military base called Londinium. It's founded by the Romans, right?
Okay.
Does that give a present day Italian person the right to come to London and take my home?
Right.
I'm asking you.
No, of course not. No, of course not.
Of course not. However, our entire international setup and community says the exact process that I've just described to you is acceptable in Palestine. That's the crux of the issue. That somebody who has absolutely no way of proving they have anything to do with anyone who lived 2,000 or 3,000 years ago has the right to dispossess somebody who, with generations of their family, have lived in the same house even, and they have the right to come and take that house from them. And this is the basis of the problem.
Right.
It's not about Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It's not about the intransigence of the Arabs in not absorbing the Palestinians and giving them citizenship in neighboring places. It's not about why can't the Palestinians just go to other Arab countries. It's
right.
that simple individual rights are being flouted for what is essentially a mythology.
Right.
It's a mythology. I can't tell you who I was related to 2,000, 3,000 years ago.
Right.
And I have no right to come and take even that microphone off you on
right.
the basis of who I believe I was related to 2,000, 3,000 years ago.
Right.
That was the British Iraqi hip-hop artist Karim Dennis, a.k.a. Loki, interviewed by the U.S. podcaster Cyrus Jansen from Las Vegas, Nevada. Loki is also an academic and political campaigner. He's a patron of the Stop the War Coalition, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and the Peace and Justice Project. He also holds a master's in Middle Eastern Studies from SOAS University of London, the prestigious School of Oriental and African Studies. This interview was posted on December 3rd, 2023 on YouTube under the title British Iraqi Activist Loki Reveals Truth About Israel and United States. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.